Tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins. The piece was titled Cutie, and that was recorded in 1957. It's 2 minutes after 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY 91 FM. On January 1st of this year, SEPTA took over the commuter trains from Conrail, and shortly thereafter, the train unions went out on strike. It looked for a while like the commuter lines might be discontinued. The commuter trains are, of course, running again, but ridership is at 73% of pre-strike levels. The system is about to be expanded and changed. The controversial commuter train tunnel opens up in 1984, the same year that the airport line is scheduled to open. A proposed fare change will be voted on tomorrow by the SEPTA board, which would generally increase fares in the city and lower them in the suburbs in an attempt to attract suburbanites who've given up on the trains. SEPTA's financial health is dependent on boosting ridership. I have two guests with me to discuss the problems confronting SEPTA, possible solutions, and changes train riders can expect in the near future. With me is David Gunn, who has been the general manager of SEPTA since 1979. Also with me is Vukan Vucic, who is a transportation expert and a professor of civil engineering at the University of Pennsylvania. He served as a consultant to SEPTA and just returned from a trip to Europe where he studied the transportation systems of Paris, Frankfurt, Munich, and Cologne. We'll try to open up the phones a little later for your questions and comments. I want to welcome you both to Fresh Air. During the strike, the importance of the trains was questioned since the city survived the strike. So before we talk about some of the current issues facing SEPTA and the commuter rail lines, I'd like to ask you first, Vukan Vucic, how important do you think the railroad system is to the health of the Delaware Valley?
The system that serves the entire region at the time when the whole city and region are spreading and growing in space is extremely important. We have been underutilizing the existing system because it was neglected. There was no innovation, no modernization for many years. The impression when the strike came that somehow everybody survived is a very superficial one. It's like saying, well, there was a horrible rain yesterday and we survived. Well, surely we survived, but that doesn't mean we want a storm every day, the whole day. There were a lot of hidden losses there that were shown indirectly in many ways.
David Gunn, you oversee the train systems in this region. How important do you think they are to the health of the Delaware Valley?
Well, I obviously am sort of biased in this matter because it's my life in the sense that I've been in the railroad or transit business for 20 years, and I wouldn't work for something or struggle for something that I didn't personally think was important. But I think that all you have to do is travel around the Delaware Valley on our what passes for a highway system and then ride our commuter rail lines, and I think it's pretty obvious to even a casual observer that the only high-speed, or in some cases, unfortunately, potentially high-speed methods of communicating with the center city from the outlying areas is on the commuter rail system. In other words, the commuter rail system does have, in some cases today, offers very high-speed service into the city, and it certainly in all cases has the potential for that, if we could correct some of the track and power problems that we have. So I think the system is important today, but it's also important for its potential, which is perhaps more important than its present use.
David Gunn, SEPTA took over the trains 1 year ago, a little less than 1 year ago, from Conrail. What are some of the problems you inherited in taking over the trains?
Well, the system has been a stepchild of private carriers for probably 40 years. The former private operators, the Reading and the Pennsylvania Railroad, and then Penn Central and Conrail all viewed the commuter rail system basically since the war as a tremendous financial drain. And as a result, there was no heavy maintenance or even routine maintenance in the last few years done on that system. So you have, for example, on the Reading, you have the entire power system is at its heart are two 60-year-old rotary converters that have failed once completely since I've been here, but which are obviously near retirement age. You have this deferred maintenance in massive amounts all through the system. The shops, the power system, the track, the ties, the rail, the bridges, the stations, stairways leading to the stations. And it's a massive problem. It's a massive physical problem. It's a $500 million problem. That's what it is.
I would add to it that there is a physical problem that Mr. Gunn described. In addition to that, there is an organizational and image problem and operational problem that everybody treated these lines as really trains going for people who are going to work into the city and out of the city. And it was operated as on a very primitive basis, rather slowly. I must say it was reliable even on that basis. But other than that, there was no modernization which took place in most other cities to increase the frequency and to connect with other transit modes and so on, to treat the public as welcome customers. That was not done, and that the whole mentality of operation has been obsolete.
Well, it was a stepchild. No one cared about it except the riders. They wanted the trains to continue to exist, but there was certainly no... The basic management thrust of the private carriers was to get rid of the system, and that's what they darn near succeeded in doing.
Would you be able to capsulize for us the plans for bringing up the level of reliability of the trains, and then we'll get to some of the specifics of that. But if there's a capsule that you could present,
well, it basically involves a fairly massive infusion of capital dollars, which are not assured, by the way. By no means are they assured. But what we're trying to do is to hit the worst spots that we have right now, the spots that are just causing us incredible problems, and correct those. For example, a Crum Creek Bridge. I mean, repair the real basket cases and get the basic system back to the point where it's functioning. And then go through the system with a program of rail renewal, tie renewal, catenary rebuilding, rebuilding the power supply at Wayne Junction, rebuilding the shops, and giving our employees a half a chance to have a decent work spot, which they haven't had up to now. And it's basically a matter of hitting the most glaring problem areas first, and then going in and upgrading. I mean, our initial problem for the next couple of years, it's going to be a matter of keeping the system from deteriorating further. I mean, anybody that thinks that system is going to rise like a phoenix from the ashes and become a super system in 2 years or 3 years is kidding themselves. It's just like the Broad Street subway. It's identical. You've got to stop the decline. And once you've arrested the decline, you begin the process of selected improvements to upgrade the speeds, to upgrade the capacity of the tracks, to give yourself more capability.
My guests, if you're just joining us, are David Gunn, who was just speaking, general manager of SEPTA, and Vukan Vucic, who is a transportation expert on the faculty of the University of Pennsylvania. One of the problems that SEPTA faces is that ridership is down, and it's only at 73% of the pre-strike level, and even the pre-strike level was lower than it had been years before. And the financial health of SEPTA is dependent on getting ridership up. And the usefulness of the trains depends on it being... of it functioning well enough so that people feel comfortable riding it. Vukan Vucic, why do you think ridership is down now, and what suggestions would you make for changing the system so it would be more attractive to its potential riders?
The ridership fluctuations were a classical example of a logical response of people to the service you offer them. We had steadily increasing ridership from 1960 to the late 70s, even without major renovations, simply because more and more people live in the areas served by the system. And also because the system is, as Mr. Gunn mentioned, competitive with the highway by its speed and reliability. Then in recent years, the financial crunch came, and in 1 year we had nearly doubling of the fares, which was one shock. The second shock was then that some of the renovations and work on the track made the service extremely unreliable, which you can have if you have every 5 minutes a vehicle and then one is delayed, that's fine. But if you have every hour and then that vehicle doesn't come, you just about lose half a day. So ridership was hit by that, and it responded by finding other ways.
You also eliminated a third of the trains. in that's 81. Right.
There
a
was
third
a
of the
drastic,
came off. Drastic,
drastic
cuts.
Cut in service. Hourly service instead of half hourly is a big difference during the day. And then came, of course, 3-month strike, where people were forced to do something else. And of course, every strike causes a loss, which later is recovered. Now we, with reopening, we were faced with a situation that you just have to. Some people will come back because out of habit and they know what it is, but some of it, the system has to fight on its merits. It has to show how good it is. Now, in that, we cannot do immediately. The system is still has a long way to go to be improved, as was mentioned. But I'm very optimistic that there is potential to improve, and the system can already today compete much better with other modes than a year ago. But the public has to be told. We have to do more marketing, more information, because many people don't know that we already have a lot of trains restored and reliability much higher than was a year ago.
One of the subjects that you just brought up is fares, and tomorrow the SEPTA board will be voting on a proposed change in fares. David Gunn, would you explain what that proposal is?
Well, there are a number. There's basically two proposals that have surfaced at this point. One is the SEPTA staff proposed a fare structure, which is basically a flat fare. In other words, to turn the high-speed system, regional high-speed system, into a transit-like operation where if you can visualize Market East, which is the new center city station, where you would have you could actually have fare barriers where you would enter the system, you would show your ticket or your pass, and once you entered the system, you could go anywhere you wanted to go, much as you can on the Broad Street and the L today. And it was a system which was designed to convert the commuter system into what we refer to as a regional high-speed system, and to be competitive with the van pools and the car pools that have really clobbered us on the outer extremities of our system. The other proposal is one that has been made by the mayor's office, and that calls for a 3-zone system as opposed to a 5-zone system, a general lowering of what's referred to as the taper in the fare structure. That is that the distance part of the fare would be less, so that you wouldn't pay as the relative fare would drop in the outer zones where we're being hit by the van pools and the car pools.
I think that van pools have gotten in. They have been advertised and stimulated by many agencies, and including DVRPC and PennDOT and so on. I think that in some areas they are justified where they do not compete with transit, but they are very deceptive and counterproductive where they directly compete with transit lines. And I think that the users will eventually notice that vanpool is leaving once a day. That's your chance. They are not as comfortable as the trains are. You're always with the same company. You always have to discuss whether they should be smoking or not. You have no choice. You cannot read. You cannot dictate your letters as well as you can on the trains. So I hope that as the time goes, that we should be getting many riders simply by noticing that trains offer better service. On the other hand, some of the group fares could be introduced to make trains more competitive.
I want to get back to the two proposals that SEPTA will vote on tomorrow. Which one do you support, David Gunn?
Well, as I said, one is a staff proposal, and it's my staff, and the other is the mayor's proposal. Fares are there's no right or wrong way with fares. I think that the staff proposal has a lot of merit. A well-thought-out zone system has a lot of merit, and I basically favor the staff proposal, but you know, I'm certainly I'm not going to sit here and say there's only one way to structure the fares. In my own view, and I think that of my staff, the most important element to regaining passengers is service reliability. I mean, we've done enough analysis of the numbers to know that within reason on the fares, in other words, the current fare structure was actually a reduction over the high point. If you remember, we dropped the taper a while back before the strike. And if as long as you have a reasonable fare structure, and I think the current one is logical, the most important thing is service frequency and service reliability. And that has come through loud and clear, I think, in the statistics that have been showing up since the strike ended.
Before we get into reliability, I just want to ask you, Vukan Vucic, what you think of the two counterproposals. And again, one, which is the one that SEPTA is proposing, has a flat fee that no matter where you're going within the system, you pay one rate. And the other is paying according to zone, which is similar to what we have now. Mm.
I would see some merits in reducing some of the long-distance fares, but I would not go so far to say that flat fare should be used. I think that there would be some reduction of revenues and feelings of inequity, and it would be especially some of the close-distance riders would feel badly.
Someone going to Germantown would pay the same rate as someone going to Paoli.
That's right.
Yes.
So I would be closer to the one with three zones. Yes.
Okay, let's get back to the issue of reliability now. And my guests, if you're just joining us, are Dr. Vukan Vucic, who was just speaking, transportation expert and consultant to SEPTA, professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and David Gunn, who was the general manager of SEPTA. You've both mentioned that you think ridership would be increased if the trains were more reliable. What plans to
frequency and reliability are both important. I mean, it's not just the current schedule being reliable. It is having an adequate schedule and a reliable schedule. And it isn't just frequency. What we did when we had the serious cutback in service a while back is we eliminated some of the lightly patronized late-night trains. Now, at first blush, that doesn't sound too bad. But what you did is you made the system much less desirable to a lot of people, because if somebody is going to, say, stay in town for dinner, the thought of missing the 9:30, if the next train doesn't leave until midnight under the present schedules, is a serious problem, because you've suddenly made them an absolute slave to a certain train when they may want to stay in town, go out to dinner, and they don't want to be pressured. Whereas if there's a train every hour up until, say, midnight, you miss one, you got a 30-minute wait for the next one. You don't have a two-hour wait sitting in Reading Terminal or Suburban Station. So it's the fullness of the service schedule pattern and also the frequency during the day.
Are there plans now to bolster
Yes.
schedule?
Yeah, we've already started that. The media line last month went back to a half-hour schedule, half-hour frequency during the day. And when we open the line to Westchester this Friday, we're having the ceremonies, and the actual service will begin to Westchester on Monday. When we open that line, that's because the Crum Creek Bridge is back in service. When we open that line, we're going to have probably the best service we've had to Westchester in years. There'll be a 90-minute frequency from Westchester into Elwyn and Media, where you change to the half-hour frequency into Center City. There'll also be two through rush hour trains from Westchester every weekday. Big improvement for Westchester. Already made the improvement on Media. And towards the end of October, there will be a rescheduling of the entire system. And at that point, all lines will basically have restored the bulk of the cuts that occurred 2 years ago. In other words, we'll fill the schedule out. Every line will have a train leaving, almost every line. There's a couple that won't. But basically, those lines that used to have full service, hourly service up until midnight, will have that restored. There'll be added service on even some of the lighter lines. The Manayunk line, for example, will have a later departure in the evening, an added rush hour train or late evening train. I think it's around 9 o'clock. Oh, the exact time escapes me. We'll add some more midday service on Manayunk. Doylestown will go to a shuttle every hour between Doylestown and Lansdale for connections to Center City. So there's a lot of changes in the mill. Plus, the Paoli line is going to have and at what we think is an improved rush hour service. In fact, during rush hour, no passenger will have to ride any train that makes more than six stops, which is an improvement over the present situation.
Most of these changes are scheduled for October.
Yes, the Westchester service goes in this weekend.
Vukan Vucic, you returned recently from a summer trip to about 5 different European cities studying their transportation systems. What did you see there in terms of frequency of trains and reliability of service that you think would be applicable for SEPTA?
I should mention that I visited with some operating people from SEPTA, the systems...
not the general manager, I might point out.
We visited the systems that that have made this change some years ago, and that have been well ahead of us in improving the services and in greatly increasing ridership also. We analyzed not only the entire planning and types of networks, but we analyzed the details of how they operate, how they advertise, how they integrate with transit, and so on. Among the conclusions and among the observations that we've brought back is exactly one that Mr. Gunn mentioned, that reliability is extremely important, that you sometimes even sacrifice a few minutes along the line, but you want to, in other words, you make a slower schedule, but you absolutely guarantee that the train will arrive when it says, the schedule says so. The second is that you schedule the train so that they go on regular intervals, so people along the line know that the trains are leaving at 17 and 47 throughout the day, every 30 minutes or every 20 minutes. And it is always so simple that people who frequently use trains don't have to carry their schedules. They also unify the fares so that when you get off the train, you want to catch a trolley or a bus, you don't have to pay another fare. There is a lot of marketing going on. The schools are informed about the system. The many school groups are taken on it. And the tourists, immediately as they come to the city to any point, they have these maps. And as anybody knows, whoever was in Paris, the maps are all over the place. In Munich, it's the same thing, and so on. And just to mention a very striking example is Munich, which also had 2 independent networks, which were connected by a tunnel 11 years ago. And their ridership went from 170,000 daily passengers immediately to 250,000, and it has been increasing ever since. And now they're at 580,000 daily passengers, which means they're nearly 4 times higher than they were with 2 separate systems oriented for commuters only. So it's a different concept. Plus, they have a very economical operations in tailoring the trains, coupling, uncoupling, and so on. Those are some of the major points. Of course, we had many other details.
Well, you just mentioned a tunnel, so I might as well introduce here the commuter train tunnel, which is scheduled to open in 1984. And that's a project that has been very controversial from the very start when it was proposed. And it was proposed and begun before David Gagneau arrived in Philadelphia. And now SEPTA has inherited the commuter tunnel. Since
not yet, but we're going to.
You're going to. That's right.
Yeah, I think we're going to.
Is it a proposal you support or a project that you support? If you had the choice now of having embarked on that, would you give it the go-ahead?
Well, I'll answer that question very directly in a minute, but let me just point out that the reality of the situation is that SEPTA is going to run that tunnel, and that it is going to be an asset to the region and to our commuter rail system. And SEPTA is going to make it work. We're going to do everything in our power to make that tunnel a success. And I think we view it as an opportunity. The question you ask me is, if I had it all to do over again, or if I were back in the whenever the decision was made, it was long before I got here, if I had the choice, would I put the money in the tunnel? The answer is no. Because what you've got now is, I think it was David Williamson who said it best, they've transplanted a new heart into a 90-year-old patient. It is what has to happen for that tunnel to work is that the rest of the system has to be rebuilt, and it has to be rebuilt fast. And you don't see the same commitment on the part of the elected officials to rebuild the toilets, so to speak. They're going to be out there cutting the ribbon on this shiny new station and mall and tunnel. But I don't sense the same commitment to build the infrastructure, and that's what we've got to fight for. Now that we have this tunnel, and it's a magnificent facility, we have to fight to get the infrastructure rebuilt, or it'll be a cruel joke. It will be a cruel joke. If we rebuild the infrastructure, it will be a big success. And I just think that it's a cart and horse situation. But it's here, it's an opportunity, and we've got to make it work, and we will make it work.
I was, a few years ago, when everybody was attacking that tunnel, I was one of very few voices defending it and writing in the papers, but I always pointed out that it really depends what we do with that tunnel. And if we don't do it properly, then I will agree that the money has been wasted and it was a wrong decision.
Now, I just want to be sure. I'm not saying that the money is wasted. The money will be wasted if we don't do the rest of the rebuilding. I just don't want to be put in a negative role.
I fully agree with that statement. But, I'm saying also,
given a choice, though, I'd rebuild the track before I built the tunnel.
It depends on if you're a pessimist or an optimist. I tended to be always an optimist, believing that if we put that new heart in a dying body, that we will be smart enough to revive the body. Because it was mentioned, Mr. Gunn mentioned, we need at least $500 million. I agree with that. It's absolutely necessary. But the decision makers should not believe that's an enormous amount of money. That's a great bargain, because this kind of system, the other cities would pay for this kind of system several billion dollars, between $5 and $10 billion, to build a new one. Go to Washington, go to San Francisco, go to other cities. You will see that that's what they would pay to build a new one. So to get such a system with 13 radial lines, hundreds of miles, 200 miles of lines, and about 200 stations, it's an enormous system, and it can be the best in the country if we provide these continuous improvements that Mr. Gunn talked about.
Well, before we get back to the fiscal problem and what it will take to rebuild the infrastructure, let's go back to the commuter tunnel and how that's going to change what it's like to ride on the trains and what the schedules are like. David Gunn, what do you think the immediate effects are going to be on scheduling and ridership?
Well, what happens, I'm not sure everybody in the audience would understand, since the tunnel hasn't been open to the public. I don't think we better describe what it does. And what it does is it connects the former Pennsylvania lines from Suburban Station with the former Reading lines, which come into Reading Terminal, so that there will no longer be stub-end terminals at Reading and Suburban Station. Instead, trains from Paoli, for example, will go through the tunnel. They'll stop at Suburban Station. They'll hit 30th Street, Suburban Station. They'll stop at a new subway-like station called Market East under Reading Terminal, and then proceed in a tunnel up to Wayne Junction. What this does is it will set up a series of linked lines. Former Reading lines will be linked with former Pennsylvania lines, so that the train service pattern, instead of trains being a Paoli line train, they will be a Paoli Lansdale train, or Lansdale Paoli, for example. And so what you'll have is you'll have the possibility at Market East for a lot of interregional trips. In other words, you can come from Paoli, if you're going somewhere up in the Lansdale area, you can stay right on your train and go through, but even if that is not your destination, and say you're going to somewhere near West Trenton or Chestnut Hill East, what you'll be able to do is just get off one train, stand on the platform, another train will come through going to your destination, and very quickly make a transfer to a new train, another train, and head on through to a destination other than Center City. So it allows an awful lot of interregional travel. It'll make it students going to Temple or people going across the center city will be able to make those trips. And that's going to be a big change in travel patterns. The other thing it will do, and this is why I'm so, I get so upset about the condition of the physical plant, is it will link the two systems irrevocably. What that means is that right now the Paoli line is sort of isolated. A delay on the Reading does not affect Paoli. once this tunnel goes into effect, a delay on the Reading side can completely foul up the Penn side and vice versa, which is why rebuilding the infrastructure is critical, because in its current condition, reliability will drop when the tunnel opens, because problems will pass through the tunnel. And that is why it's a race against time for us to try to get some of the more desperate problems resolved so that you don't have a complete fiasco when that tunnel opens. But initially, with the plant in its present condition, reliability will drop.
Do you think that this syncing up of the former Reading and Pennsylvania lines are going to bring us any closer to the European systems that you've described, where trains are synced up and you can go from one part of the region to another with greater ease?
Definitely. There have been a number of cities which have done similar things. It was Brussels and Paris and Munich and Frankfurt and many others have done that exactly because it really... it's not only the facility, it's not that one-mile tunnel or whatever it is, and it's not only connecting the lines, but it changes the character of the entire system. It becomes a regional transit. So that's why I keep calling it regional rail system rather than commuter. It's not only commuter. It's much more than that. And a typical example of what it will do will be the airport line, which if it would open without the tunnel, it would serve two stations in Center City and the airport. And it would certainly not have anywhere the number of passengers that could justify that investment or even operation. Once the tunnel opens, anybody from any line in the region can get on the train and, as was described, get off at Center City and get on the airport train or have direct airport train going into the airport. That is our problem. The service will be much more complex. It has to be more reliable. It has to be better information for people and so on. But that's also our challenge and our chance to make a unified system and tie it closer with other transit and so on.
Now, the potential for the tunnel is great, but there's a lot of risk. And if the region doesn't come through with the proper support for the rail system, it's a joke.
SEPTA just took over the trains less than a year ago. Do you feel that SEPTA is equipped at this point to take on the monumental task of managing the tunnel now, too?
Well, sure. I mean, I think we're doing a fairly decent job with the rail lines. I think SEPTA, in the last few years, I think, has demonstrated a capability of running a pretty decent system, I mean, under some incredible odds. And we have a fairly decent track record of producing a good service, given the resources that we have. And I don't think that's the problem. The problem is, will the elected officials fund it? I mean, they've got this investment, which is a new heart and a 90-year-old man, as we've said. Now, are they going to come through and continue to support the system? Are they going to just stand there and, when it breaks down, throw stones at SEPTA, which is a very easy thing to do?
What do you think it's going to take to rebuild the system so that it's on a level with the new tunnel?
On the rail system, it's a $500 million investment over the next 5 to 10 years.
And that would be for what?
Well, it's for basically plant, for rail, ties, bridges, power, shop facilities, and some new equipment. We still have, excuse me, we still have... 38, what we refer to as Reading Blues, which are 50-odd-year-old cars in service, which have to be replaced. That alone is a $50 million bill to replace those cars. And if there's going to be any growth, you've got to have if the fleet has to grow to allow you to handle them. But the bulk of it is infrastructure repairs, bridges, rail, ties, stations, and so forth.
David, just to clarify a little bit... this amount of something like $500 million would not be all local money, of course.
No.
There are a lot of federal funds, and for that reason, the local share is extremely important because sometimes inadequate local share may prevent us from getting 5 or 10 times that much as a total into the region.
We're funded through a federal program where the federal government provides either 80 or 75% of the project cost. Depends on the the section of the UMTA Act that the money comes from. That means that the state and the local governments have to provide either 20 or 25% of the project cost. And in the case of the 80% money, for example, that means the state puts up 16 2/3% and the local county and city governments put up 3 1/3%. And we have come very close to losing. This year, we came very close to losing $150 million in federal money because of a shortfall in local match. At the last minute,
of these 3%, right?
Well, no, it was the state fund this time, but it's both. I mean, you have problems with both. This time, the state did see fit, thank God, to come through with the match money. So our capital program will continue for another year. We can seek out and acquire federal funds, but that has to continue.
My guests are David Gunn, just speaking, who is the general manager of SEPTA, and Vukan Vucic, who is a transportation expert on the faculty of the University of Pennsylvania and a consultant to SEPTA. I'd like to invite you to call with any questions that you have, and our number is 923-2774. We're at area code 215, the number again, 923-2774. Maybe we can look at Europe again as an example of how funding works there. Many European cities have excellent, comprehensive mass transportation systems. Where do they get the money from? What kind of funding system is there?
It varies from country to country, but most of the countries have had a much longer national commitment to not only good transit, but good urban transportation and healthy cities. And in Germany, for example, they introduced in 1967 a rather modest surcharge tax on gasoline, which was allocated to urban transportation, part of it to transit and part to streets and highways. And that has brought so many millions and billions that German cities have been very busy building, and they are healthy, they are progressing, they are in much better shape than they ever were. And that's very obvious as soon as you come there. And their fare policies and all of this has been stabilized much more. It's less subject to political discussions every year. It's institutionalized through various funds.
Okay, let's take our first phone call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes, I am very gratified to see that both Mr. Vucic and Mr. Gunn are declaring their commitment to a regional transportation concept in terms of public service. However, as a person with some experience over the past 8 years in the commuter rail service, I would like to ask Mr. Gunn whether there is any hope in the future for electrification to Newtown.
Yes. In fact, we hope to begin the engineering, the actual design of the electrification this fall. And providing we get the local share, the county share, the line will be electrified.
Uh-huh. Have the plans for any service whatsoever north of Norristown and Lansdale been terminated?
Well, we have no plans to extend into non-electrified territory at this point. There were two, I don't know whether they were companies or associations that were attempting to establish a service in that area which would be subsidized by counties outside the five-county region. And both of those efforts, to my knowledge, failed.
Thank you for your call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air, and I'll ask you to keep it brief.
Okay. I know that there's only one set of tracks from Erie to Fernlock, and there are two sets of tracks per direction below Erie. Now, if there were another set of tracks built for which there is space there, that would reduce the problems in running the express trains and the local trains. Are there any plans for building the second line of tracks?
Yes, our desire is to build the express tracks in those the space that's there in the tunnel between Erie and Olney.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a $5 million project, and I can't tell you when it will take place or really if it will take place, but it is something we would like to do.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
Thank you for your call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air. Please keep your question brief.
Yes, I have two questions. As far as a compromise between comfort between our subways and the trains, Have you considered the comfort of the metro in Washington and also the money spent on the regional rail lines when they are converted to transit, such as the overhead or any of the money? Will that be able to be used on the transit equipment?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
I thought you said you were going to convert the rail line
operation? No. What I said was a transit-like operation, or at least that's what I should have said. In other words, to get the frequency. Right now, you're dealing with lines which basically rely upon a timetable. In other words, a train comes once an hour, and you have to have a timetable. Our goal, to the extent possible, is to get to a headway situation, such, for example, on the media line, where you have a train every half hour, and perhaps even get to a 20-minute headway, so people are just that occurs on a regular clock face interval, so that people can begin just to walk to the station, knowing that if they get there at about 10 after the hour or 30 minutes after the hour, that there'll be a train, and if they miss that train, there'll be another one in a short period of time. There's no change technologically contemplated. In other words, we're not going to a DC operation.
Okay, thank you very much for your call. If you're just joining us, I have two guests. My guests are David Gunn, who is just speaking, general manager of SEPTA, and also with me is Vukan Vucic, who's a professor in the civil engineering department at the University of Pennsylvania, a transportation expert who just returned from a trip from Europe studying transportation systems there, and he's also a consultant to SEPTA. Our phone number for your questions about the rail lines is 923-2774. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi. One of the most common objections I hear about taking the train to Center City from the suburbs is the one about how, yes, it's a great ride to Center City and it's real fast, but once you're there, you have to walk fairly long distances to get to where you want to go, or you have to pay another fare for a cab or wait for any one of a number of confusing array of buses. One possible way to help alleviate this problem is to allow bicycles on trains. However, SEPTA or Conrail or whoever runs the transportation system has been rather antagonistic to this possibility in the past. I might add that it's a way of increasing ridership without having to expend any more money. Is this policy ever going to change?
Well, I don't know. But I do know, when I was in Boston, I worked for the MBTA in Boston, we experimented some with trains on bicycles on trains there. But we had a series of cars that had baggage compartments in them, which gave us a place to put the bicycle. And without that, you have a really serious liability problem and a serious just congestion problem moving the bicycle on and off the train and stowing it on the train. And while it would be nice to have, and I agree with you that it would make it a attractive trip for a number of people, I think that it's a physically difficult thing to do, given the fact that we don't have high-level platforms and given the configuration of our cars. It's really tough to stow the bicycle. It's not, if you got one or two, it's not a big problem. If you get 20 or 30 people showing up with bicycles, it slows down the operation, getting them on, particularly, it's tough. And the liability problem is serious. And for us, the liability problem is a very, very serious matter. We're now consuming almost 10% of our operating expenses paying claims.
I see. Are there other solutions to this problem that have been tried in other cities, perhaps in Europe?
Yes, some of the steps have already been done. For example, if you have a monthly ticket on the rail system, you can now use any bus and trolley and subway free, so you don't pay another fare in the city.
That's in at SEPTA.
SEPTA.
Yeah.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And the tunnel will somewhat improve that, so that if you're coming from Paoli, you can go to the Market East and walk to the Independence Mall area. If you're coming from Reading, you can go also to 30th Street Station, and sometime in the future to Civic Center with a new station and University area and so on. So there are some of those organizational things that can improve somewhat better even than bicycles because of the physical problems that Mr. Gunn explained.
Thank you very much for your call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
When will the new fare structures be decided and announced after tomorrow's board meeting, please?
Well, if the board acts tomorrow and approves a fare structure, it will be announced immediately. The implementation date will depend upon what they vote.
Let me ask you what the pricing would be if they went with the SEPTA recommendation of the regional system where it's one fare for a ride anywhere.
Well, there's a lot of different fares, but it's $61 for the monthly trail pass. Wasn't that the number? There's so many numbers floating around, I've lost track of which is which, but it was $61 for the monthly trail pass. In other words, for $61, you could use the system anywhere.
And the single rides would be, I believe, $2 in off-peak and $2.50 in peak,
right.
Something like that.
Okay. Thank you very much for your phone call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Oh, I'd like to make one comment. Every time I hear about SEPTA and all the money and the tunnel and accessible, making it reach farther and do all these things, that I think I, as a disabled person, can't use the system at all. And I feel very angry about that. I feel, as a citizen and a taxpayer, that all this money is going to for transportation, and I'm excluded. And I wondered if Mr. Gunn would like to address that, or if there's any plans anywhere to help people like me be able to use the system.
Well, we have, in the last year and a half or so, we've instituted our paratransit system, and it's expanded fairly steadily since it went in, and it's now citywide. And we hope to link up in the counties with some services which will make it contiguous with our present service territory. So we do have a service which is available to a large number of handicapped people. In our paratransit service. In terms of full system accessibility, if that's what you're asking, in other words, making the subway accessible to wheelchairs and making the buses all accessible to wheelchairs, you're talking an incredible amount of money when you
talking about billions of dollars, but every time it comes to, then we're talking a couple of million dollars or $50 million, and then that becomes, outrageous.
Well, we have tried to address the need with our paratransit system, and I don't know where you live, but if you're in the city, that is available to you.
And some of the buses are.
That's right. We have about 298 RTS2s, which are equipped with wheelchair lifts, and the first 150 Neoplans have wheelchair lifts on them. So some of the bus routes are currently equipped with wheelchair lifts.
Okay, thank you very much for your phone call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello. I ride the Lansdale line in and out of the city, and I was wondering what could be done to have the schedules actually reflect the work that's going on in the line. None of the trains are arriving or departing on time on that line, and it's discouraging a lot of riders.
Yeah, we've had a very hard time on the Lansdale line, and the big problem is the track work, I'm sure you know this, that's going on above Jenkintown. And we were operating single track for an extended period of time. It was not supposed to be so. What happened to us is we had a contractor who did not perform, and we kept getting trapped by, you can blame us because it was our contractor, but he kept giving us completion dates and then missing them. In fact, this month he has missed six dates so far. Now, the piece of track, today you should have had that piece of track open and in service. But that was a very bad situation where we had a bad contractor and I don't think we handle it as well as we should. Now, West Trenton, we've started track work on the West Trenton line, and we immediately ran into problems. We had a slow order occur simultaneously that we didn't expect on some Conrail track we operate over. And we did, within a matter of 2 weeks, in fact, it went into effect today, I believe, put out a new timetable. And we should do that, and you're right. Because what happened on that Lansdale line was inexcusable. And if we have anything to say about it, the contractor won't do any work for us again.
I would just support the complaint of this caller as a sufferer from the media line from a few months ago and press on Mr. Gunn that in these cases, There should be much more attention, at least telling people when the service will not be there, and then they'll accept it. They'll bear with SEPTA.
No, we did an absolutely miserable job on media, on the informational side, and we did a poor job on the Lansdale line. I hope we're learning, and I think that on the West Trenton line, we responded much quicker when we saw we couldn't get out of the problems caused by both our track work and a Conrail slow order.
Thank you for your call. I have a question that I'd like to ask. I think for people who live in the city, I'm not sure how it is in the suburbs, that one of the things that might discourage you from taking the trains home at night is the danger that awaits you in the subways, in the train stop once you get to your neighborhood. A lot of the Germantown stops, for instance, are not lit well at night. Sometimes you'll be at a stop and the light's gone out, no one's fixed it, and you can barely see your hand in front of you. And it's really very, very dangerous. Whose responsibility do you think it should be to ensure the safety at the train stops, and does SEPTA have any plans to address the safety issue?
Well, the whole matter of the safety of our passengers, I think, is an issue that the perception is a lot worse than the reality in terms of what happens to our passengers. We have had a fairly successful campaign, I think, to reduce and control the crime on our system and against our passengers and employees. And the crime rate today is down by over half of what it was a couple of years ago. And we're now to the point where the system is basically very safe. Statistically, you're much safer on SEPTA than you are walking around on a city street, I think. But it's our responsibility to provide station lighting and to give you a spot to get off the train. And we do have our own police force now. We have 130 officers. And we take the protection of our passengers and our employees very seriously.
I should add, certainly it's SEPTA's responsibility for the stations, but we cannot just load that on SEPTA. Some of the townships have been very cooperative, but some of them have not. And they just say that SEPTA cannot really pay such attention to every station in the region. Some of them are 30, 40 miles out. And it is also those townships that should cooperate with SEPTA much closer. And the riders who are unhappy about it should also call their township people to say, let's get together with SEPTA and improve this situation.
Okay, well, we only have a couple of minutes remaining. I'd like to ask each of you to tell us what you think we as riders or potential riders can expect in the next year. And it's going to be a big year. We've got the commuter tunnel opening. Within the year, we've got the airport line opening. There's possibilities for great advantages or for chaos. So
be very careful making predictions. You know, somebody sat and predicted the airport line would open in 1976. So I'd be careful.
Right. Well, what do you want to make any predictions or comments about what you think the next year holds in store for riders and potential riders?
Well, let me just start off, and I think that the first thing that we haven't talked about, and I don't want to dwell on it, is that, you know, SEPTA has some very serious funding problems, and we always do, and I'm sure the audience, I can see the phones going off right now as soon as I mention funding. But, if we don't solve those, I think that you're going to be very disappointed as to what you see in the way of service. But I would hope that, assuming we've solved those, that you will see a gradual stabilization of the commuter rail system and that you'll see the system gradually starting to get better. I would hope that the transit system would continue to improve.
I would say that there have been four things that happened recently. One was SEPTA's complete takeover. The second one was the new labor contracts and much more efficient operation and economical operation. The third will be the tunnel, and the fourth will be the airport line. Those four changes are creating the basic physical and organizational conditions for a transformation of this system from one that served a very limited patronage to one that eventually the entire region will find as a very useful system, really the strongest system connecting the entire region. Provided the funding and understanding from different public bodies is given, as Mr. Gunn mentioned, I think that the potential of this system is much greater than most people recognize, and it should not be our goal to restore 130,000 daily rides. I think we should go for twice and more times that in the next 5 to 10 years.
I want to thank you both very much for spending the past hour with us. It's been very informative, and thank you. Both of you, just speaking was Vukan Vucic, who's a professor in the civil engineering department at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a transportation expert, has studied systems around the country, and just returned from a trip to Europe in which he studied the transportation systems of five cities there. And he is a consultant to SEPTA. Also with me has been David Gunn, who since 1979 has served as the general manager of SEPTA. I want to thank also our listeners who called with their questions and comments, and thanks again to both of you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. We enjoyed it.
It's 2 minutes to 5 o'clock. All Things Considered is coming up at 5 from National Public Radio. I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air after this traffic report from Shadow Traffic.
Good afternoon, everyone. Major problems on northbound 95. If you're traveling home that way, you're going to find 0 to 5 mile per hour average speeds for 5 miles from Tasker Avenue all the way up to approaching Allegheny Avenue due to an earlier motorcycle accident. Now, all lanes are open, but the delays can be expected. Now, because of this, the Ray Street on-ramp to northbound 95 has been closed by the police to help alleviate some of that backup. Now, what you have to do is follow Ray Street to Delaware Avenue, go north on Delaware Avenue to the Girard Avenue on-ramp to northbound 95, but all of that is also heavy, so Center City traffic heading to 95 is backed up because of this problem. Delays, of course, can be expected. No major problems elsewhere. Your westbound Schuylkill Expressway between University and Vine a little bit slow, the normal slowing on the Roosevelt Extension. Tacony-Palmyra Bridge expecting an opening about 7:30. A couple of open fire hydrants causing problems. Lindbergh Boulevard near 66th Street and Woodland at 55th, so caution should be used. That's Shadow Traffic for WHYY 91 FM. This is John Brown.
The Shadow Traffic Report was funded with a grant from Superfresh. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we'll hear a documentary called No Way Out about teenage suicide, and we'll be hearing from several teenagers who attempted suicide and failed and lived to tell about why they had tried that. We'll hear from friends who are survivors and from people who are professional counselors. That's coming up at 3 o'clock. At 3:40, rock critic Ken Tucker hosts Hearing Secret Harmonies. And at 4 o'clock, I'll speak with Mona Doyle, who's the director of the Consumer Network, and they survey consumers about what they find attractive or unappealing in consumer items, and they offer that information to corporations. So we'll be talking about consumer items tomorrow and opening up the phones for your questions and comments. That's coming up at 4 o'clock. Technical director for today's show was Fred Snyder. Assistance was contributed by Abby Ginsberg. The associate producer of the show is Maeve McGoran, co-producer Danny Miller. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Susan Stamberg.
And I'm Robert Krulwich with All Things Considered.
Find a way to be flexible on your economy. Find a way to move towards human rights. Find a way to demonstrate a little independence on foreign policy. We'll be there.
A message from the Vice President of the United States to Warsaw Pact nations who decide to buck the Kremlin. Tonight on All Things Considered, a conversation with George Bush about U.S.-Soviet relations.
And these stories, Eastern Airlines proposes a wage cut, the unions say no.
President Reagan gets a mixed reception at a meeting of world bankers.
Syria closes in on the PLO.
Maxim's of Paris is opening in Peking.
And in New York, they're dancing for cash. First, this news.
This is Brian Naylor. There were more sniping attacks on Lebanese soldiers in the southern suburbs of Beirut, and an Italian member of the multinational peacekeeping force was slightly wounded in day two of Lebanon's tenuous ceasefire. There was also fighting in Tripoli between rival factions of the Palestine Liberation Organization that left at least 9 people dead and 17 wounded. Wrangling between Lebanon's warring militias delayed the opening.